Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline, What Do the Insiders Know That We Don't? Shining the light on the bulls and bears inside the Triangle's largest public companies in 2015. And that's the headline on the front page. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. Bulls and bears among us. On average, insider sales outnumber purchases by threefold at Triangle public companies in 2015. And this article is written by Sarah Cheney. Conventional wisdom suggests insiders buying and selling their own shares often provide clues about the company's future direction. With a litany of restrictions imposed by federal regulators to avoid insider trading issues and other inappropriate fiscal maneuvers, in today's world, company executives, board members, and even its largest shareholders buy and sell stock for a variety of reasons beyond just telegraphing the company's future earnings or losses. Most C-level executives and board members use a U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission provision that allows them to sell shares of their own concerns at a future date and on a regular basis. Other reasons for selling include diversifying holdings or distribution of stock, but still reviewing stock sales data over a period of time may signal whether the company is about to run with the bulls or hibernate with the bears. It's no secret that Wall Street was piping hot in the first two quarters of 2015, with the Dow peaking in May at 18,312, but the last two quarters it gave back almost all the gains. With this much volatility in the stock market, insider stock sales data of Triangle public companies show management and board members of these companies were more interested in selling shares than buying them. In the first half of 2015, the Triangle's 20 largest public companies filed 159 insider sales transactions, three times more than the number of insider purchases during the same time period. In the latter half of the year, however, the number fell more in line with 130 transactions, with sell side running 1.5 times the buyer side orders. Najat Sehun, author of Investment Intelligence from Insider Trading, studied insider activity from 1975 to 1995 and found that stocks bought but not sold by insiders outperformed the market by 7.5 percentage points during the 12 months following the insider purchases. On the other hand, companies whose insiders sold underperformed the market by 6.1 points. It's important to pay attention to what insiders are doing, says Michael Painchaud, director of research at Market Profile Theorems, a Seattle company that tracks insider sales. It's something you should take into consideration when investing, he says. Skin in the game. Experts agree Wall Street favors companies whose insiders own a sizable portion of their shares because of its skin in the game mentality, but there is a balance. If insiders own a controlling stake of their company, traders and analysts balk because of predictable operational behavior with limited upside. Take Morrisville's MaxPoint Interactive. More than 70% of its stock is held by insiders. With a limited float and the stock currently trading at about $1.45 per share, the interest level among stock traders is minimal. On February 19, about 45,000 shares were traded, alarmingly low for a company that early last year was consistently trading 150,000-plus shares. But the broader point of insider ownership has many benefits, experts say. Even the venture capitalists who are funding them, they want to know that the founders put a good portion of net worth in the company and convince their friends and relatives to do the same thing, says Alexander Arapoglu, a UNC Chapel Hill finance professor. Raleigh-based Martin Marietta, materials insider, sold heavily last year, which conflicts with Market Profile Theorem's findings that investors up their buying in energy and basic material sectors. Martin Marietta didn't respond to requests for comment. Those areas are areas that have been heavily beaten down in terms of share price, Pinchot says of the energy sector. Corporate insiders are saying, geez, I understand my own company, and if commodity goes up just a little bit, our company should rebound sharply. Insider selling is more common in high-tech regions, Penshaw says. Arapoglu gives two reasons for the large percentage of insider sales relative to buys in the triangle: the need for these startup-type companies to diversify investment holdings and the need to raise wages to competitive levels. Notable exceptions. Xerum Technologies of Youngsville was an exception to this ratio of sells to buys. The company recorded 31 buys and 10 sales in 2015. One company insider, Tocqueville Asset Management, gobbled up shares in the latter half of 2015, cashing in on 27 different occasions. Xerum didn't respond to requests for comment. Yatkin Financial Corporation recorded 3 insider transactions for 2015, the smallest of any of the largest triangle companies other than PRA Health. If you look over the last 3 or 4 years, there's been no insider selling unless it was for tax purposes, says Steve Jones, chief banking officer at Yatkin. If you had $100 worth of stock, when you exercise your options, your stock options, it's basically just like income. Now you have to pay $36 in taxes. If you don't have $36, you have to sell some shares to pay for taxes. SEC oversight. In 1934, the U.S. Congress passed the Securities and Exchange Act, restricting company insiders from trading on the basis of material, non-public corporate information. For instance, this law makes it illegal for insiders to buy their stock if they know their company will be acquired, which would lead to an increase in stock price. These restrictions would seem to indicate that insider trading wouldn't influence stock prices because insiders wouldn't be acting on non-public information. However, there have been a few studies that show insider trades affect stock prices differently than non-insider trades. The SEC will investigate such actions and is expected to enforce insider trading law violations, yet in practice, insider trading on non-public information may occur and go undetected by the SEC, says Jillian Popadak, assistant professor of finance at Duke University. In my experience, corporate insiders have a very long-term view, a 3 to 5 year view, in terms of their fortunes going forward, Panchaud says. People shouldn't think about them as being short-term hair scalpers. And along with this article, we have a section called By the Numbers, details on some of the Triangle's insider deals in 2015. MaxPoint Interactive filed 31 insider purchases in 2015, one of two companies among the Triangle's 20 largest public companies to record only buys. Over the same period of time, MaxPoint shares declined. Currently, MaxPoint shares sell for $1.63, down about 90% from the same time last year. Channel Advisor recorded 29 insider sales and 10 purchases for 2015. In November and December 2015, Patrick Cairns, a company director, sold a total of 556,692 shares. Channel Advisor shares sell at around $11 currently. Chimerix recorded 4 insider buys and 19 sales in 2015. Martha Dembski, a company director, recorded the most insider transactions. Chimerix shares sell at near $5 currently. At First Citizens Bank shares, there were 13 insider purchases and 19 sales in 2015. All sales occurred in the first half of the year. Shares sell for about $230 currently. Red Hat recorded 35 insider sales and 0 purchases for 2015. 14 of these sales occurred in April. Currently, company shares sell for $61. Among the 20 largest Triangle companies analyzed, Quintiles recorded the largest number of insider shares transacted in 2015. The majority of Quintiles' activity came in May 2015. On May 19, the company announced the closing of a secondary public offering of 11,855,050 shares of its common stock by its shareholders at a price of $65 per share. Quintiles shares hover at $62 currently. And Inc. Research filed 51 insider sales in 2015 among various officers. Shares sell for about $40 currently. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. Glittering Gala raises more than $900,000. With more than 650 people in attendance, the annual American Heart Association's Heart Ball netted a touch north of $900,000, up more than 25% from last year, Biz is told. Decked out in their tuxes and evening gowns, attendees such as former Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina CEO Bob Gretchen, Crabtree Valley Mall owner Samuel Longiata, UNC Rex surgeon Ravi Shakar, and Bank of America's Virginia Parker were among hundreds of local business executives who spent their evening bidding and dancing the night away on February 10. For the latest full fiscal year, AHA officials note that the organization has given away more than $9 million in research funding to local medical institutions. Steve Burris, CEO of UNC Rex, was named the chairman of the 2017 Heart Ball. It happened one night, bounty of festivities, awards, and music. On the same night when the Downtown Raleigh Alliance was hosting its annual meeting and the Colorado band Big Head Todd and the Monsters, known for its Sister Sweetly platinum album, was playing at the Ritz, there was another special event at the Cotton Room in Durham. The American Advertising Federation's Triangle chapter was hosting its annual awards gala, and Clean Design founder and CEO Natalie Perkins went home with the Silver Medal Award, the highest individual honor given out by Triangle AdFed, recognizes individuals whose exceptional careers have contributed to the betterment of the Triangle creative community. Biz chatted with Perkins, whose company is celebrating its 20th year in the Triangle. It really shows if you surround yourself with smart people and let them do their job. Recognition and respect becomes part of the byproduct, Perkins says. I am truly humbled to receive the award. As for the DRA event at the Raleigh Convention Center, more than 1,000 people listened to Peter Hirschberg, a self-made technologist known for preaching disruptive culture and how entrepreneurs and corporations must change to stay relevant. But just before that, recently retired Convention Center head Roger Krupa, took home DRA's Leadership Award honors. Hotels received 2016 Forbes ratings. The Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary received 5-star ratings from Forbes Travel Guide for both the hotel and the restaurant Herons. The Farrington Inn in Pittsboro, however, dropped to 4 stars, although its restaurant retained its 5-star rating. Here are their managers' reactions. First, Jim Bealey, general manager of the Umstead Hotel and Spa. I am pleased to work with these young professionals who truly care about serving others in a polite and caring manner. We decorated our employee cafeteria with white tablecloths, candles, and some shining stars. The kitchen prepared roast tenderloin of beef, lobster macaroni and cheese, and steamed asparagus for our daily meal. This along with a full salad bar. A benefit of working in a hotel is that your work meal is free. And from Teresa Ciantini, general manager of the Village Center, which includes the Farrington House Inn, restaurant, and spa. Obviously, we're disappointed. We fell short this time. I do feel that smaller properties are having to keep up with the standards being set by the big box hotels like Four Seasons and Ritz-Carlton, and we're just a small family-owned property. Hopefully, this was an anomaly, and we'll be able to get it back next year. TBJ staff bring home 12 NC Press Awards. Triangle Business Journal and its staff received 12 awards from the North Carolina Press Association for Excellence in News Reporting in 2015. The awards were presented on February 25 at the association's annual recognition event at the George Watts Hill Alumni Center on the campus of UNC Chapel Hill. The TBJ News organization won first place for general excellence for its weekly edition. In addition, Jason DeBruin won the prestigious Henry Lee Weathers Freedom of Information Award for his cover story on company expansions that North Carolina lost to other states. In North Carolina's win-loss record, The award is given annually for advancing, upholding the cause of freedom of information and excellence in reporting on access to government-held information and the First Amendment. In this category, TBJ was competing with daily and weekly state news organizations under 20,000 in circulation. TBJ's reporting and design team netted 6 first-place awards. Jason DeBruin for online breaking news coverage of the Salix pharmaceutical sale to Valeant, culminating with the weekly edition cover story, Meet the Salix Steelers. DeBruin also won first place for sports enterprise reporting with the cover story, Seriously, we could never get another pro franchise. Jeff Jeffrey for general news reporting on the North Carolina ports in the cover story, At Ports, Size Matters. Amanda Hoyle for Beat News reporting on the North Carolina companies claiming the largest tax credits in 2014 in the cover story, North Carolina's $400 million hangover. Dathan Kuzak for appearance and design of the weekly edition. Kuzak was also won first place for the special section 40 Under 40. Second place awards were presented to Lauren Onasorge, Hoyle, and Jeffrey for online breaking news coverage of the Charter Square fatality, and Jeffrey received a second-place award for his cover story on workplace accidents, Fatal Work. DeBruin also snagged 2 third-place awards for online breaking news coverage of Sprout Pharmaceuticals obtaining FDA approval for its breakthrough women's libido drug and its subsequent acquisition by Valeant Pharmaceuticals International, and for education reporting on apprenticeship programs in the Triangle in the cover story, You're Hired. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle, and there's a section called On the Drawing Board. Luxury apartment community underway near Carolina Country Club. Raleigh real estate developer Gordon Grubb is partnering with Florida-based Styles Residential Group to build a new luxury-style apartment community overlooking the prestigious Carolina Country Club property. The 186-unit mid-rise property, to be called 2600 Glenwood, will be located on the former Kipdell Homes property at the intersection of Glenwood Avenue and Oberlin Road inside the I-440 Beltline. Demolition had already started on the site, and new construction is expected to begin in March, with the first move-ins anticipated in early summer 2017. The gated community will have a mix of 1, 2, and 3-bedroom units, with special emphasis on the higher-end condominium-level finishes and appliances. The property will also have 3 resident club rooms, a cafe, resort-style pool, bocce ball court, and a terrace overlooking the Carolina Country Club golf course. Downtown partners assemble land for a mysterious Smoky Hollow building project. A new joint venture partnership formed by North Hills developer John Kane and Raleigh real estate veteran Cross Williams has purchased the Southland Ballroom and ThemeWorks buildings on a prominent site on Northwest Street in downtown Raleigh. Neither party, however, is disclosing details yet regarding what they plan to do with the site on the northern edge of downtown Raleigh. The project is internally being called Smoky Hollow, after the historical blue-collar neighborhood that used to occupy that area of Raleigh before redevelopment efforts took over in the 1960s. The property is also already zoned for mixed-use development up to 12 stories high with shopfront frontage. County records show the Kane-Williams joint venture paid $4.6 million for the 1.24-acre lot and buildings at the corner of West and Harrington Streets. The property is also adjacent to 4 other parcels on 2.44 acres between North Harrington and West P Streets that are already owned by members of the Williams family. Big retail hotel site proposed for Raleigh's Wake Forest Road. The Chapel Hill owners of the former Alcatel office site on Wake Forest Road near the Interstate 440 Beltline in Raleigh have for the first time formally disclosed development plans for the land that the group has owned since 2003. The plan for the 23-acre site located between the Costco and Trader Joe's stores involves splitting it into 2 lots, one for development of a 154-room hotel and another for construction of up to 195,500 square feet of new retail development. Co-owner Kevin Benedict declined to comment about the plans for the Wake Forest Road property. "We still need to get a few things figured out," he says. The group also includes Chapel Hill investors Sherman Richardson, Laura Van Sant, and a few others who were also part of the Main Street Properties development team that built the 300 East Main mixed-use building project in downtown Carrboro. Ridgewood area apartment plan put on hold. Plans introduced in 2015 to redevelop part of the Ridgewood Shopping Center with a high-density apartment building on Wade Avenue in Raleigh are on hold for now. Ridgewood co-owner Andrew Teckett says they've decided to reevaluate their options due to the project's construction costs and ongoing concerns regarding neighborhood support, which had largely been critical of the plan. Teckett says they have more immediate plans, if approved by the city, to tear down a single-story building on the east end of the property, currently occupied by Crescent Dental and a couple of other service operators next to Rite Aid. The building would be replaced by a two-story retail and office building that would add an additional 18,500 square feet of rentable space at the center. And in a separate article, MI Homes kicks off project in Raleigh's Brookhaven neighborhood. MI Homes has launched construction of a new infill housing development within the long-ago sold-out Brookhaven neighborhood community off Glenwood Avenue and Millbrook Road in North Raleigh. The new community, called Reserve at Brookhaven, is located on Ponderosa Road and will have 40 single-family home sites built among a forest of pine trees. All of the lots will range from a quarter acre to a half acre, and the homes will range from $595,000 to more than $670,000. And finally, in a section called Apartment Market, a recently released ranking report of the top buy and top sell markets among the multifamily real estate sector in the U.S. by 10X, formerly Auction.com, ranked the Raleigh-Durham metro area in second place behind Orlando as the top markets for investors to buy into multifamily investment deals. The 10X forecast report was based on third quarter 2015 data, but a more recent market apartment index report by Charlotte-based Real Data gives even more credence to the accolade. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Technology page written by Lauren Onasorge. The main article, What NetApp Layoffs Mean for RTP Ops, Company to Cut 12% of Staff. A 12% headcount reduction at NetApp will impact the company's Research Triangle Park headcount, the company confirmed February 17. But what remains unclear is how it will impact the internet storage giant's state-incentivized growth plan in RTP. The job cuts, which CEO George Kurian says means $200 million in annualized savings, are part of a $400 million cost-cutting plan. They include the consolidation of hardware and manufacturing operations teams, and notifications have already started, according to Kurian. NetApp spokeswoman Megan Fintland said in an email that the reductions are a difficult but important step in aligning our cost structure and resources with the opportunities ahead. In RTP, NetApp has pledged major growth. In 2012, the company pledged to invest $75 million and to create 460 jobs over 4 years in RTP in exchange for incentives from the state. Fintland said the company was continuing to work through the restructuring process and couldn't comment on whether the latest announcement would impact those plans. Until we have more specifics, we are not able to quantify any potential impact this may have on our ability to meet the job creation targets that are in our community economic development agreement with the state, she said the day after the layoff announcement. Plant science firm picks Triangle. Plant Impact, a British plant science firm, has picked the Triangle for its new North American headquarters. The company's U.S. subsidiary, Plant Impact Incorporated, will establish its permanent offices in the Research Triangle Park region, the firm said in a prepared statement. The new U.S. and North America business for plant impact follows several years of consistent yield improving success for the group's technologies and products in other markets, in particular Brazil. Plant Impact deals specifically in what are called crop enhancement products, products developed to improve the quality and yield of crops, often applied in small quantities via seed treatments and sprays. Plant Impact products combine chemicals in both synthetic and naturally occurring biostimulants, and the company does not use genetic modification in its compounds, according to the website. Products are manufactured in the UK at three outsourced contract manufacturers. And in a section called They Said It, the first quote, "It's making sure people can't hack into your building through your ceiling." And that's from John Bakelmans, Cisco's London-based CTO of the Internet of Everything Solutions Group, talking about priority one for Research Triangle Park-based researchers working on smart connected lighting with Durham-based Cree. Another quote, "These guys aren't out trying to take over the world anymore with grandiose plans built on a paper napkin. They are much more mature operators." And that's from Rich Lee, serial entrepreneur behind Hosted Solutions, which was sold to Windstream, talking about what he calls the main difference between Triangle innovators a decade ago and today. "We are approaching around 80 people on board for the new center." And that quote is from Dennis Bloss, vice president and general manager in North Carolina for Frontier Communications, providing an update on the 200-job expansion in Durham the company announced last fall. And then also we have a section on fundraising. North Carolina startups snag $1 billion in funding in 2015. North Carolina broke the $1 billion milestone when it came to equity funding in 2015. The Durham-based Council for Entrepreneurial Development released its 2015 Innovators Report, which tracks technology-based entrepreneurial activity in the state. "We're seeing a greater number of large deals and a continuing increase in out-of-market investor engagement, both positive indicators for the health of the state's entrepreneurial ecosystem," says Jane Seaford Rose, CED President and CEO. And finally, and then there's also an article under expansion. Sentinel Data Centers adding 120,000 square feet in Durham. Enterprise data center operator Sentinel Data Centers is expanding its Durham facility this summer, building out an additional 120,000 square feet. That includes 50,000 square feet of white space and up to 10 megawatts of critical load. Sentinel co-founder Josh Rubina says the decision to expand was driven by occupancy at the Durham site, which already houses 100,000 square foot center. "We've had quite a few large users join us and sign new leases over the past few months," he says, estimating that the current phase is north of 85% when it comes to occupancy. Already, the expansion, dubbed Phase 2, is pre-leased at about 20%. And finally, in a section by the numbers, $1.2 billion. What 170 entrepreneurial companies in technology, life sciences, clean tech, and advanced manufacturing and materials collectively raised in 2015 through 191 equity investment deals. 19, the number of deals of more than $15 million inked during 2015 compared to 6 in 2014. 98, the number of technology companies raising money in 2015. $516 million, what technology companies raised. 52, the number of life sciences companies raising capital in 2015. $584 million, how much life sciences companies raised. 146, the number of institutional funders investing in North Carolina companies in 2015. 28 from the West Coast. 36, the number of investments that came from North Carolina. And 24, the number of investments that came from California. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page, written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, Failed Trials Clobber Chimeric Stock. Investors have hammered Chimeric shares in the past 2 months, but Chief Executive Dr. Michelle Berry kept her focus on ways the drug developer can bring its lead investigational drug, Brincidovir, before federal regulators for approval. After Chimeric announced it halted two Phase 3 trials on Brincidovir, Berry said the company still plans for the continued pursuit of developing the drug for other indications, even though those front-running indications have now shifted. The disappointing trial results hurt Chimeric's value. For perspective, Chimeric's market value was up to $2.68 billion at one point last year, but that dwindled to $224 million by February 22. Despite the canceled trials, there is evidence that Brincidovir holds potential, and Chimeric's executives remain positive about bringing the drug forward through other trial avenues. Already, Chimeric is testing Brincidovir for the treatment of adenovirus and smallpox, and it has consistently shown a good safety profile. Analysts also kept a positive outlook. Dr. Joshua Schimmer, a senior research analyst with Piper Jaffray & Company, who covers Chimeric, continued to rate Chimeric stock as overweight, with a price target of $18. With multiple viable paths forward for the product, including smallpox, adenovirus indications, and an IV formulation, our confidence in Brincidovir's outlook is actually increased, he wrote in a February 22 research note. On February 24, Chimeric stock closed at $5.03 a share. FDA okays Durham developed seizure therapy. A troop of employees from the Research Triangle Park operations of Belgian drug maker UCB Biosciences wore some big smiles on February 22 as federal regulators approved a therapin which they had worked. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved Briviact as an add-on therapy for partial onset seizures in patients with epilepsy. European regulators approved the treatment in January, and the therapy is already available in Germany and the United Kingdom. UCB employs about 275 workers in the Triangle, including about 15 contractors, roughly 40 colleagues on site from clinical operations, quality, and patient safety were involved to reach this latest milestone, according to Christoph Jensen, UCB Vice President of Global Project Management and RTP site leader. And in a section called Big Numbers, $350 million, $1 billion. What GlaxoSmithKline paid upfront and could ultimately pay in addition to acquire the HIV portfolio from Bristol Myers Squibb. And in a section called They Said It, I'll put it this way. We were one of American Airlines' best customers. That's from Jim Dayton, BioAgilytics CEO, who along with BioAgilytics founder and chief scientific officer, Dr. Afshin Safavi, made countless trips to Hamburg, Germany while courting IPM Biotech, which BioAgilytics ultimately acquired. And the next quote, we were thrilled to have Kim rejoin the MedFusion team last year, and I am even more delighted to now welcome her into the role of CEO, where she will have the opportunity to help build the future of the company. And that's from Steve Malik, MedFusion founder, after the company announced Kimberly LeBeau as its new chief executive. And now we turn to the A Better World page in the Triangle Business Journal, starting off with the column from Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. The headline of the column, Foundation Supports Local Schools. Each August at a teacher store offered in partnership with the East Chapel Hill Rotary Club, new teachers, school social workers, and about half the other teachers in the Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools can pick up classroom supplies using a $75 voucher. Teachers also are eligible to receive $1,000 per year for 2 to 3 years from 10 endowed chairs, as well as scholarships to help cover the cost of applying for national certification and professional development grants, and first-year teachers receive $100 grants. Launched in 1984, the Chapel Hill Carrboro Public School Foundation has raised and provided more than $5.4 million for local public schools. In the face of declining teacher morale as a result of cuts or threatened cuts in funding, the foundation works to make sure the teachers feel valued and they know they're making a difference in children's lives, says Lynn Lehman, its executive director. It also focuses on students with the most need, both financially and academically, she says. Operating with an annual budget of $325,000 and a staff of one full-time employee and three part-time employees, the foundation counts on its board and volunteers. Each year, the foundation hosts three big fundraising events, such as Walk for Education, which last fall raised $185,000, including corporate sponsorships, with 85% of the funds going back to schools for projects. Its 5K for Education each spring generates about $10,000 and includes 6 weeks of fitness training for teachers for $25 each, provided by Fleet Feet Sports. And it hosts a Teacher's First Breakfast and Roses, which receives donated food from the Chapel Hill Restaurant Group, Spanky's 411 West, Mez, Page Road Grill, and Squids, and discounted roses from Whole Foods. Last year, the event raised $95,000, mainly for programs that support teachers. The foundation also received support from individuals, including one who last year donated $55,000, and from the Stroud Roses Foundation and other philanthropies. But generating funds through its annual appeal remains a challenge, Lehman says, and the foundation has hired Executive Service Corps of the Triangle to help it develop a strategic plan that could set the stage for fundraising or campaigns to build its operating endowment, which now totals $108,000. The foundation also operates 32 endowments totaling $1.5 million that support endowed chairs and other programs. Teacher value and student success are the challenges of the district and the things we try to address with our enrichment grants, Lehman says. And now in nonprofit news, J.P. Morgan Chase gives $1 million to UNC Center. During a February 17 breakfast meeting at the Carolina Inn, an announcement was made that through the support of a $1.05 million grant from J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, UNC Chapel Hill Center for Community Capital, or CCC, will develop innovative strategies and solutions to help under-resourced communities become more vibrant and economically inclusive across the nation. Opening remarks were made by UNC Chancellor Carol L. Folt. Key speakers were Lucy Gorham, CCC's executive director, and Craig May, Carolina's market manager at J.P. Morgan Chase & Company. Pope Foundation grants $1.8 million in North Carolina. The John William Pope Foundation recently awarded $1.8 million to North Carolina nonprofits in its winter grant cycle. Of that, more than $1 million went to humanitarian organizations that meet hunger, housing, and health needs, primarily in the Triangle region. That figure includes $400,000 to the UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center to help fulfill a $1.3 million pledge made in 2014. Biogen Foundation funds STEM programs. The Biogen Foundation has awarded $125,000 in grants to support science education programs and projects in public schools across North Carolina. In its second year, the foundation's Ignite the Power of STEM program awards teachers, schools, and nonprofit STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, education programs that serve K through 12 students. And Special Olympics North Carolina kicks off campaign. The North Carolina Law Enforcement Torch Run for Special Olympics has kicked off its 2016 campaign of raising funds and awareness for Special Olympics North Carolina. The Torch Run unites officers in the law enforcement field from across the state in an effort to raise funds and awareness for Special Olympics North Carolina. And now we turn to the small business section in the Triangle Business Journal, and we start with the column written by Kent Hoover. The headline, EEOC form blasted as burdensome. Agency underestimates time businesses will spend on compliance. The proposed form the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission will use to collect pay data broken down by sex and race sure looks intimidating. The form includes 12 rows for different pay levels in 10 broad job categories, ranging from executives to service workers. For each of these rows, there are 15 columns identifying employees by gender and ethnicity, not just white, black, or Latino, but also Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander, Asian, Native American, or Alaska Native, or two or more races. Human resources professionals say the EEOC has underestimated the time and cost involved in compiling and reporting data that break down how much employees are paid by sex and ethnicity. Employers also would have to tally the total number of hours worked by employees in each pay band over the past 12 months. Under a proposed regulation, employees with 100 or more workers would have to file this form beginning in September 2017. The EEOC already requires such employers to count their employees by sex, race, and ethnicity, but now it wants to collect information on how much they're paid. This will enable the EEOC to focus its resources to more effectively enforce federal pay discrimination laws, the agency says. The EEOC estimates it will take the average employer only 6.6 hours to compile the data and complete the form at a cost of $160. There also would be a one-time cost of $378 to develop information systems tracking this data, the EEOC estimates. Both estimates, quote, are not credible and reflect EEOC's woeful misunderstanding of the speed and ease by which complex and customized data can be compiled from computer information systems, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce writes in a letter to EEOC. If EEOC had made the effort to interview experienced information system and human resource management professionals in affected establishments about the feasibility and cost of compiling the proposed data, EEOC could have arrived at a more realistic estimate, the letter states. The chamber plans to do this research on its own, but it says that can't be completed by April 1, the deadline for public comments on the EEOC's proposed regulation, so it asked the EEOC to extend the comment deadline until June 30. Early comments on the proposed regulation are overwhelmingly negative. It's obvious those working for the EEOC who came up with this new reporting requirement have never worked outside government, one commenter wrote. Special reports to capture pay data outside of the normal tax reporting cycle cost money, whether created internally or by a payroll vendor, and the time estimate for completing the forms underestimates the complexity of the request. Because businesses don't look at their data in this way, aside from assembling the report, employers will want to spend time understanding the data before submitting. The burdens described in the notice, and these are more comments. The burdens described in the notice do not square with what I know will happen to us, a company of between 125 and 150 employees, another commenter wrote. First off, our HRIS is not tied to payroll. Second off, we can't modify the HRIS system. We would be dependent on the vendor to update the HRIS product. And because of our industry, hours worked is actually tracked in a third separate system. Even with all this additional burden for employers, the EEOC won't get other important data that may explain pay disparities such as seniority, experience or educational background, performance, production levels, the applicant pool, how the position was posted, advertised, and other job-related factors, another commenter noted. The EEOC has always had the ability to seek this information from an employer if a discrimination complaint is filed during its investigation. And those comments were part of the an opinion piece written by Kent Hoover. And also in the small business section, there's another headline for a column written by James Lee. James Lee is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. The headline, "These Family Business Stories Aren't Mere Fairy Tales." A couple of weeks ago, I received a letter from a Denver reader of this column who complimented me on the little family business stories I make up to illustrate points about owning and running family companies. "How imaginative," she wrote, "and they're so lifelike." As a matter of fact, none of the tales I tell in this column are fictional. Names are always changed for reasons of privacy, and the narrative is often edited to fit the column's space allotment. But the problems, plots, and interactions as I describe them are right out of the daily lives and dilemmas of business-owning families that I know and have dealt with. I have a couple of file drawers full of authentic family business scenarios that might show up here in the months ahead. Here's a sneak preview. The takeover. When Maria's husband died, she and her three daughters continued to be active in the family's real estate brokerage and development firm. But her youngest daughter's husband convinced Maria that four women had no business trying to run such a complex company and talked her into assigning him increasing management authority and even control over Maria's majority share of the ownership. By the time two of the daughters confronted him about decisions he was making that benefited him but not the business, the son-in-law had enough power in the company to tell them to clean out their desks and buzz off. He still continues to manipulate assets while his attorneys stall the daughter's lawsuit. The turnaround. As a teenaged only child, Charlie had proclaimed loudly and often that the last thing he wanted to do with his life was take over running the four generations old family farm where he'd grown up. The long hours and back-breaking labor, the constant government fiddling and the unpredictability of weather and crop prices were too much for him. So Charlie went to engineering school and took a fast-track designer job in Silicon Valley. Because of his background, he found himself a team leader in the development of agricultural management software that took a lot of the guesstimating and hands-on work out of managing a large farm. And the more he thought about it, the better life in the good old Midwest seemed. So one day he made the call. "Hello, Dad. This is Charlie. Say, if I come home this weekend, can we have a serious talk?" The downsizing. Howard and Robert were both vice presidents of their respective companies and managers of electronics manufacturing plants in the Seattle area. Their big difference was that Howard worked for his family's business, while Robert was employed by a publicly owned company whose parent corporation is headquartered in Chicago. When a downturn in customer demand began seriously squeezing the entire industry, Robert got an order from his home office to downsize his plant operation and reduce his payroll by 40%. Howard's family board of directors decided just to hunker down. They adopted a lean but loyal policy that focused as much cost-cutting as possible on non-labor items, such as suspending dividends and family executives' perks, and kept workforce reduction to less than 10%. When the marketplace's confidence returned, Howard re-revved his plant's productivity in less than 60 days. Robert's capacity was too eroded to restore, so his parent company closed the plant. The interim leader. John was the textbook family business founder, and his son Bill was the perfect successor. John had poured his life into building the company into a solid and profitable organization. Bill had an MBA and a lot of savvy about the modern marketplace. He knew his family's company inside and out, and he was a skilled manager and natural leader. The only thing that stood in the way of a smooth handover of management and ownership was the fact that John and Bill couldn't be in the same room for more than 60 seconds without an argument breaking out. Ultimately, the company was saved and continued to grow into a family business powerhouse because John hired an experienced executive to serve for 3 years as interim head of the company. The interim head accepted the management handover from John and later passed it along to Bill. It was no textbook succession transition, but the essentials were taken care of without family conflict, bringing the business down. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page, where we read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, the editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Street Actions Reflect Banking Sector Dilemma. Ask any publicly traded bank executive about the state of the banking industry, and they will give you an earful about how Wall Street is hammering bank stocks. Through the beginning of February, the financial sector within the S&P 500 umbrella was down 12%. That's in the 5 weeks of 2016 alone, folks. Executives are doing everything to bolster confidence by offering arguments as to how banks will mitigate the potential energy sector crisis and slowing global economy, but investors are not buying it. As of early February, more than 40% of the banks were trading below their tangible book value, a Barclays report noted recently. You have to go back to 1990 during the first Gulf War to paint a comparative scenario. But things are much different than they were some 25 years ago, and banks may have a bigger problem with real estate as they chart future strategy. I am talking about retail branches. A third quarter 2015 report by BI Intelligence shows about 38% of U.S. millennials have never visited a bank branch. The survey was done after talking to 1,500 banked millennials aged 18 to 34 years. So, will banks start closing retail outlets soon? That may be a few years away, but it is unlikely that most banks will be constructing new branches. There is a silver lining to this old-fashioned retail banking, however. A report on checking account trends from the 8 Group last year concluded that the majority of people opening a bank account still would prefer to go to a retail branch and talk to someone. 8 report states 73% of individuals opening a new checking account in 2014 used a bank branch to do so. Of those, 80% were of Generation X or were millennials. For now, however, banks have to figure out their revenue pipeline under a stricter regulatory environment. If they don't want to loan because they are afraid of default, and if people won't move new money to banks because of abysmal rates, what's the call here? The KBW NASDAQ Bank Index is down some 20% for the year so far. In contrast, the Dow Industrial Average is down about 7%. Maybe it's time to jump into bank stocks for some. Buy low, sell high. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the People on the Move section, where the spotlight is on Rick Edwards, CFO of CEPI Engineering and Construction. Finance veteran Rick Edwards has stepped out of the banking arena and become the first person to hold the title of Chief Financial Officer at CEPI Engineering and Construction. In his new role at CEPI Engineering, Edwards is responsible for all the finance, corporate governance, treasury, IT, and certain human resource activities of the company. Previously, Edwards was CFO of Square One Bank and later CFO of Trust Atlantic Bank, where he met CEPI Engineering's founder and chief executive, Sepita Saidi, through her involvement as a director on Trust Atlantic's board. After Trust Atlantic was sold to First Tennessee Bank, Edwards joined the engineering firm to lead its financial operations. CEPI Engineering is a 15-year-old full-service engineering firm with offices in Charlotte, Wilmington, and Raleigh. The firm currently employs a total of 230 people, about 110 of whom are based in the Triangle. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? It's a lot more about debits than credits. What are some of your major goals for your new position? I want to build on the profitability of the company and continue to support the company's growth. I also want to build and enhance the infrastructure to allow the company to grow and expand. Biggest pet peeve? Having to redo work a second time. I want to get it right the first time. Biggest worry? Another significant recession or economic downturn. Triangle area business person that you most admire. Steve Shroud, chairman of NAI Carroll Atlantic Realty. Education, bachelor's degree in accountancy from the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. Personal, wife Karen, children Kim and Jill. Last book you've read, Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can of another Viewpoint article. It's a column under Energy Talk headlined, Offshore Energy Important for North Carolina's Economic Future. And this article is written by Michael Watley, who is the Executive Vice President of Consumer Energy Alliance. North Carolina's picturesque beaches are among the state's greatest, most lucrative natural treasures, attracting millions of tourists, countless anglers, and billions in economic activity each year, and dozens of miles offshore, even more economic possibilities await. That's because our waters also have some of the country's largest untapped reserves of natural gas and oil, and hundreds of thousands of acres currently under consideration for offshore wind development. It is important that we fully and appropriately balance the need to protect the environment and develop energy resources. Far too many Americans live paycheck to paycheck and having safe, reliable, and affordable energy, all while continuing our incredible run of protecting the environment, is critical to meeting basic household needs. Don't take my word for it. Take Abigail Ross Hoppers. Hopper is the director of the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, BOEM, the federal agency responsible for the environmental protection and economic development of our coast, and recently stated, "I don't think it is an either-or conversation," she said. "I think we move forward on domestic energy production on oil and gas and renewables." Director Hopper's comments were made at a recent Atlantic Energy Forum hosted by Consumer Energy Alliance, CEA, in Raleigh, where experts on both sides of the debate made it clear that traditional and renewable energy will continue to drive the state's economic well-being and quality of life. And we're going to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.